Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
And we're in business, folks. Thank you, Patricia. Okay, well, live from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, this is Week to Week, the Political Roundtable for Monday, September 25th, 2017. Welcome, everybody. Now, of course, you all know the world did not end this past weekend. It was supposed to. We're going to talk politics. You might wish it had ended, but we'll see. I'm John Ziffer. I'm your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. I'm very glad to be here with all of you, everyone watching us online, and this fabulous panel right here. On today's program, we're going to discuss the president and athletes, the healthcare repeal effort, the U.S. response to hurricanes, the U.S. response to North Korea, and the latest free speech flap at Berkeley. So much to talk about, of course. We'll try to fit this all into 1 hour, and we will end our program with our live news quiz, your chance to win some chocolate. So as I always note, the Commonwealth Club of California has people of a wide range of viewpoints, so any opinions that are expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. Let's start at the far end of the stage there with Marisa Lagos. She's a reporter for the California Politics and Government folks at KQED. You can follow her online at mlagos. So welcome, Marisa.
Thanks for having me.
Next to her is Barbara Marshman, the editorial pages editor for the Mercury News, and she's on Twitter at Barb Marshman. So welcome, Barb. And next to me is Carla Marinucci. She's the senior writer for Politico California Playbook, and she's on Twitter at C Marinucci. So Carla, welcome. Let's get right to it. Now, to me, one of the more surprising news stories to kind of take over the news of the past few days has been the president taking on the NFL and taking on professional athletes, and he kept at it. He was doing it just in the today as well. I think I first noticed it when he notified the world that because Steph Curry for the Golden State Warriors had said he did not want to go to the White House, as the championship teams usually do of all the sports, therefore, President Trump was canceling their invitation. And then right, it's like he
just rolled into
it. Yeah, rolled
in. I like that you're still surprised, though. Like, I'm impressed.
Yes, that's very cute, John. Yes.
I keep thinking he'll reset. But, of course, he then went into going after Colin Kaepernick and NFL players who take the knee instead of standing up during the national anthem. So, let's start with you, Marisa. What do you make of this?
I mean, it seems, you know, we were talking about this a little before. Is this, like, a planned move by Trump? Is this something to distract from healthcare in Puerto Rico and North Korea? I'm not sure I give him that much credit. I mean, this is a president who seems to lead by sort of, like, stream of consciousness. And so it does appear that this was something, and who, you know, clearly in the past is quick to I don't know, have his feelings hurt, I would say. So it did seem to me to be a response to the Steph Curry comments. I mean, interestingly, we should note that the team hadn't officially decided whether to go or not. And so they were supposed to vote on that over the weekend. It certainly sounded that likely that they might all vote not to, and that or that Steph Curry might not go. But yeah, I mean, it's been really fascinating. And to me, the most interesting thing is how this has snowballed within the NFL to have all of these, you know, owners who are donors to Trump, friends of Trump, in very red states like Texas even tonight, still kind of joining this protest. And, you know, it must feel like validation to Kaepernick, right, who's basically been blackballed. And you do wonder, like, is this going to change his fortune?
Yeah. So tonight you're talking about Jerry Jones. The Cowboys.
Yeah.
Yes.
But also the Patriots owner. I mean, these are people that gave a lot of money to Trump. So this is not just, you know, crazy liberals in San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's been interesting to watch how much the Bay Area teams have played into this, played a role in this. Steph Curry, of course, one of the most beloved figures in sports, defended by LeBron James. You know, interesting to watch. These guys have as many Twitter followers or more than Donald Trump. It's really the first time he's taken on people who on social media have...
Are like his level,
are,
kind of.
Are at his level of play.
Well, and their Twitter followers don't speak Russian. So it's, right. It's easy to communicate.
Yeah. You know,
and also the fact that you had the Bay Area, like, sending love to Cleveland was in itself, right? A moment.
And, you know, you had the Oakland Raiders, which is the only African-American lineup in sports, taking the knee. You had the A's catcher becoming first baseball, Major League Baseball player. I think it is a distraction. I think that's, you know, you're watching Trump do this in a week in which he's facing the healthcare legislation disaster, the hurricane issues. He's got the Mueller investigation. All things are piling up, and this is what he does, is throw out something to just, so everybody looks at the shiny object again and doesn't focus on the real issues.
I think that's true. I also think there's an interesting parallel here with the war with Korea, which could have a little more consequence.
Thank you. You had
Trump tweeting that Kim won't be here for long, and then Kim saying, well, that's a declaration of war, and then the White House going ballistic today saying, no, 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 we don't want regime change. But I think he does go into these things ultimately as a distraction. But I think it started the same way. I think Curry just ticked him off, and he went with it. He feels things very personally. He and Kim have this thing going. I have no idea where that ends. I don't want to think about it. But I think I think it's similar in motivation.
But I also think, I mean, yes, of course, compared to nuclear war, this could be called a distraction. But let's, like, this is also the continuation of a decades-long conversation in America that I think has really resurfaced in the last year because of Trump and his divisive campaign and because of what happened in Charlottesville. And so, you know, I think culturally that this is a moment and that this does stand to have broader implications around race relations and kind of how we don't, you know, confront them in America. And so, you know, to your point about like kind of taking on people at his level, I think that having all of these players who, yes, are maybe millionaires now, but most of whom did not grow up like that, you know, this may play to his very core base, but I don't think it necessarily helps him long term politically.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the hypocrisy here is pretty obvious when you talk to the president tweeting that this is not about race. That's astounding right there. His issue saying that the NASCAR teams are with him, that's not exactly true. But we know that those audiences
Pat Tillerson.
Pat Tillerson.
Trying to claim that he would be with him. I mean,
that was awful.
Yeah.
Well, a frequent week-to-week panelist, Dr. James Taylor, sent me an article this morning. Some of you have probably seen it, in which ESPN commentator Stephen Smith was pointing out this whole controversy wouldn't have happened, or at least not happened this way, a decade ago. It wasn't until 2009 that he started even having the teams on the field. This is before, you know, pregame stuff, during the national anthem. They were always still in the locker rooms, playing cards, arguing about the game, whatever, counting the money, I don't know what it, but, I mean, there was a conscious effort at that time, though, to get the players out there, you know, showing solidarity or whatever.
Yeah. And to hear, you know, the press secretary, Sarah Sanders, say numerous times today that this was about, you know, national pride and patriotism. At the same time, where was the president's outrage when during these rallies of neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and where Confederate flags were being shown? I mean, those are the questions.
And leave it to the NFL and ESPN to make money off of this, because they just started broadcasting the national anthem on Monday Night Football tonight for the first time. So, like, you know, it's political, but...
Well, it's interesting how many, and I've seen this, especially on the folks criticizing the players for not standing with their hands on their heart during the national anthem, saying they're dishonoring, you know, the flag, they're dishonoring various things. Someone tweeted today, thinking NFL players are protesting the flag is like thinking Rosa Parks was protesting public transportation.
That's a good line.
There's something else they're talking about there.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, to be contrarian then, civility on both sides. LeBron James calling the president a bum.
I'm with her.
I mean, yeah. it was nicer than a lot of the words Trump uses.
Oh, yeah. Like,
yeah.
I
mean, I think when you're talking about civility and you're talking about some of the president's tweets, we've gone past that whole issue.
But you know who's been really articulate are some of the coaches and owners. I mean, if you look at Steve Kerr's comments, Greg Popovich, like they are really, and I think especially having these very white, powerful men make these really nuanced comments about race and sort of civility, it does at least stand to shift the conversation.
I also think Steph Curry had, it was a three-pointer, his answer, that this is not what leaders do. He didn't call him names. He was just, it was just a class act the way he responded to the president.
The lack of civility really frightens me, in part because we do what Marisa just did and say, well, that's what he does. We all do it, and people are always, an editorial page, why didn't you write about this? Why didn't you write about this? Can't do it every day, It's just this, and it does numb you after a while, but totally. It's a horrible thing. And people, parents or PTAs are saying there's more bullying in school. It's becoming an accepted thing to call names.
Yeah, I'm glad my kids are young enough to not be watching the news right now, because you have the president calling, people terrible names, and it's not defensible, no matter what side of the political aisle you're
right.
on.
Well, let's move on to another heated area, which is healthcare. The latest, there's a lot going on right now, that not just with the latest congressional Republican attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but we're also seeing Bernie Sanders pushing for single payer. Start with you, Carla. What's happening right now? Well, first, let's get an update, because things have happened just today, recently, on the Senate bill. So
we have Susan Collins of Maine saying she's not going to vote for this bill, which seems to put a stake in the heart. But, hey, this bill is the walking dead, I don't know, until the final vote is taken. Yeah. I'm not sure what else they make. The fact is that in the final hours, in the last iteration of this bill, the Republicans wanted to throw money at Maine, Alaska, Kentucky, Arizona. Gee, why were these states were all
wanted
and
to
Texas,
throw our money at
yes,
Maine.
All our money at there. California was going to be the state that was going to be hardest hit. The estimate was $28 billion by 2027. One out of four Californians expected to lose their health care. And, of course, why? Because California signed on early to those Obamacare regulations and got that money. And you kept hearing the Republicans saying, but so many of the state, the big blue states are getting all the money. It's because the big blue states
expanded.
Looked out for their people.
Also, we have more people here. They're acting like this isn't equitable. I mean, to me, I thought, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska have been really pivotal Republicans in this whole thing. And one thing I learned this week that I hadn't realized was that, Murkowski got a challenge from the right in Alaska, got knocked off in the primary, won as a write-in candidate, as Murkowski. Like, most people can't spell their own senator's name, So I do think when you look at her and Collins, you have to consider, what do they think they owe the Republican Party? And clearly, I mean, she's coming from a very different place than Rand Paul. But her statement to me was really interesting because, as you say, Carla, they've been trying, Cassidy and Graham have been trying to sort of throw money at these wobbler senator states to kind of bring them over. And what she basically said was a few billion dollars in the short term isn't going to help when you decimate Medicaid. And so to me, that was important, not just for her constituents, but also because she seems to be looking more broadly at this, which is something, we don't always see, honestly, that people are worried about their constituents in their next election, but not always as concerned about the greater good. And I think that's fascinating. Yeah.
I mean, what seems to be the big mystery here, John, is, when you look at the polls on this legislation, 52% opposed it. Only 20% of the voters out there approved of this legislation. And this is the way it's been all the way along. Mm. People were very concerned when they saw the issues of, Medicaid, what was going to happen to older seniors, what was going to happen to folks in nursing homes, low-income kids, pre-existing conditions, you name it. Yeah. And yet the Republicans insisted on moving forward with this.
So is it better off, are the Republicans better off for this failing than if it had gone through?
They've set themselves up as this being a measure of what they can do, but I don't understand it. I mean, the promise that was made during the campaign by the president, at least, was better health care for everyone, less expensive. Those three things, it's what he said every time. And yeah, if they can keep that promise, I'm with them. But but they don't seem to make the connection that just repealing is going to take care of that. And I don't know if this helps or hurts in the long run, because I don't understand the whole dynamic, really.
I mean, I think it depends on the district, right? We were discussing before we came up here how some of the Republicans in California, whose districts were won by Clinton, Republican congressmen, are being challenged, you know, from the left by, in some cases, several Democrats. And, you know, maybe someone like that, Jeff Denham out in the Valley, Ed Royce down in Orange County, are not, maybe they might be kind of secretly going, thank God I don't have to vote
bill right now.
But yeah, as a party, I think that there's definitely going to be some people who are mad. You know, it's also, I think, important to note that as this happens and as, you know, the latest vote at least appears to fail, you still have the Trump administration actively trying to undermine the ACA. They have announced that they are going to take the enrollment site down every Sunday for 12 hours during enrollment period for maintenance, right? So these are like...
And cut back the advertising that informs people about how to enroll drastically.
So, right? Yeah, so I mean, they're going to continue to try to undermine the ACA in ways that, you know, I think especially is one thing if you're a Medi-Cal, but for a lot of people that get these subsidies, it's a very, you know, healthcare is complicated and that outreach is critical.
I was interested. We published an op-ed from someone who pointed out, and it's true, that 60% of the people on Medicaid nationwide are working people. They're working for small businesses that don't offer benefits. And they're 60% of the individuals on Medicaid have jobs.
Mm-hmm. And if you're wondering why there's this frenzy this week and last week, it's because the end of this month is the end of a period when the Republicans in Congress could pass this with only 51 votes. And after this, it goes to, would it be 60?
60 votes, yeah. Unless they change the rules.
Yeah.
So this can go on for another 4 years.
Okay.
Good time.
Yeah, something to look forward to.
It's a single payer, huh?
Well, let's move right into that. Bernie Sanders, is actually, right now, he's debating the Graham and Cassidy on CNN.
Right. That's right.
So let's talk about Bernie. Carly, you've been
writing
a lot about
this. Yeah, he was here in San Francisco on Friday, had a big rally at Yerba Buena Center. Mm-hmm. I think you saw the beginning of Bernie Sanders 2020 at that rally. He went after Trump in a lot of different ways, but also sort of threw down the gauntlet on single payer. He was there with California nurses, thousands of them. They got behind Gavin Newsom there, basically expressed he wants to see the California bill come back and go before the legislature and see that. The fact is that the polls do show that people are in support of single payer, but the question is the details here.
There's
who's
no money.
For it? Yeah,
there's no money on the table for any of this.
Meaning what? I'm sorry.
So I think, you know, let's take the Sanders bill, which they're kind of promoting as a Medicare for all, though it's actually more generous than Medicare. Politically, what's interesting to me is how far the Democratic Party has been pushed by Bernie and everything that's happened in recent years. I mean, you have every sort of young up-and-coming senator who's rumored to have an eye on 2020, including Kamala Harris, backing this bill, co-sponsoring it. I mean, something that, you know, 4 years ago, no Democrats wanted to touch, I think, has become sort of, you know, the holy grail in some ways. I mean, but yes, the question is deliverability. And in a state like California that's deep blue and where, you know, Democrats have super majorities in the state Senate and assembly, the governor's office, every statewide office, it got stalled this year for money concerns. Now, I do have to say, like, when we talk about these huge figures, that doesn't account for the fact of how much we're all paying right now, right? So there is some money that, you know, out there. And if you're going to shift around taxes and payments, like, let's be clear, most of us pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in our employers every month for this already. But I do think that California is a little bit of a litmus test for this and for people like Bernie who really want to see this nationally. But unraveling our entire, you know, insurance system is not
an easy sell. On the other hand, you know, people look at it and say two of the most important constituencies out there, seniors and veterans, already have a single-payer system, right?
Yeah.
So why can't they be extended to other people? That's the question Bernie Sanders, I think, has been very, very skillful in asking and putting out there. As you said, Barbara, that the question about how this gets done in a state like California. Now, Gavin Newsom has said, hey, we did it in San Francisco. Of course, you know, did that really happen?
Did they really?
I mean, it's not single-payer. It is.
Yeah.
There's some health. There's a health safety.
There's a health
here. That is a different thing than insurance, right?
But some people have worried. Some Democrats in Congress have worried that this is taking. That this happening now, is at a time when they should have been focused.
That's right.
On
I mean, a lot of Democrats. Cassidy, say, Bernie Sanders. Why are you talking about single payer? This iceberg is coming at in the Graham Cassidy bill. Well, that's. It looks like it's been destroyed at least for now, melted for now. But you know, the Republicans may come back at it, and a lot of people are worried that at this debate tonight, we'll see how it goes, that the Republicans will use Bernie Sanders and go, there go the Democrats, socialist medicine, mm-hmm. They're at it again.
All of them.
Yeah.
All of the Democrats.
Yeah.
And take the focus away from some of the real issues.
I mean, it is just fascinating, though, to have this such a divide, right? I mean, we have the Republicans trying to undo the ACA, which, you know, is not as generous as I think most people would like, even if they don't want to pay for it. And then you have the Democrats going in the exact opposite direction. And it just shows, you know, how far apart, how polarized this nation is.
And we're going to see if, you know, they can really cross the divide. They keep talking about reaching across the aisle. Can we all sit down together and improve the ACA, which everybody agrees has many problems? But there's just been no sort of incentive.
Well, and that was John McCain's message there, right. Which was we've tried this, you know, both sides,
right.
You know, without really getting a good compromise.
Right.
Which isn't entirely fair, I would say. I mean, the ACA was a compromise.
Yeah.
Yes. It's just that in the end, nobody voted. None of the Republicans voted for it. But there was it was way different from the way it started, and it was fundamentally based on Mitt Romney's.
That's right. Republican principles, you know.
In Massachusetts.
Well, let's move on to stormy weather. We've had a barrage, that's an understatement, of hurricanes down in the Caribbean and off around Florida. Right now, we're probably witnessing a humanitarian disaster unfolding in Puerto Rico. Obviously, I want to talk, we're not a weather program and we're not a rescue program. So let's talk about the politics of that, if you will. You know, is every time there's something like this, people kind of like, well, is this the Katrina moment for Obama? Is this, Donald Trump's Katrina moment? When the systems they're supposed to use during emergencies are not handled well, they're not managed well, they're not run well. So, Barbara, you first. What do you think?
I think everybody, when the hurricanes were going through, everybody was saying, the federal government was right there. We so appreciate them. We appreciate the government. How about that? But now with Puerto Rico and with the U.S. Virgin Islands, not seeing the help and not seeing Trump stand up, you know, Trump's budget dramatically cuts FEMA and cuts the very kind of response that you need after a disaster. Puerto Rico has no power. A lot of people don't have water. And nobody really knows what's happening inland on the island. It's a big island.
No, and you have a situation here in which it has been 6 days since the president has addressed this on Twitter. At the same time, he keeps talking about the NFL. And you've got 3 million American citizens on this island in conditions that people are describing as hysteria now because it's hot, there's no drink, no potable water, seniors, babies, hospitals are without it. And we've heard nothing from him except for an hour ago.
Yeah. Which talked
when
about
when he talked about the effect on the banks, I think, didn't we?
Banks and Wall Street. he mentioned that, you know, Puerto Rico has all these problems, and of course we have to deal with Wall Street and the banks, and but we're going to help them.
I mean, I've been hearing from days from people who can't reach their relatives in Puerto Rico. Yeah. The whole island is completely out of pocket,
out of power. Yeah.
And I mean, this is a human tragedy that who knows how many lives we're going to lose here. The fact that he hasn't said a thing on it, I think, finally came home to him today because he got a lot.
After he got some pushback on Twitter.
He got a lot of pushback on Twitter, right.
But he took care of Wall Street.
Well, when President Trump called for the U.S. military to immediately send help to the people of devastated Puerto Rico, wait, that was Hillary Clinton. She sent that message.
Yes, she did.
What was it, a day or two ago?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so...
No, people and are talking about how they should be sending aircraft carriers. Yeah. We're talking about a huge humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, I mean, the FEMA director did show up there, so I guess that's something. But yeah, it's interesting. They haven't suspended some of the rules they suspended for Harvey and Irma to help, you know, in Florida and in Houston. I think that, this does stand to be, and it's not Obama. Obama was not president during Katrina.
No, I knew that, but
George
I mean,
they,
yeah. what did,
but that's a mis-
when something happens for Obama, right. they're like, well, is that going to be
your
Katrina his
moment.
Katrina?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But this could be his heck of a job brownie moment.
Yeah,
if people are paying attention. And, you know, I got to say, like, just... If you're looking for coverage, I do think like the AP has been having some amazing reports out of there. They have a lot of reporters on the ground, and I think, I do think this is one of those moments too where like we in the media have a responsibility to be highlighting this and to not be distracted by just the NFL and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and when we watch something like this, it's not just watching a humanitarian disaster of people who are fellow citizens. Because our hurricanes here are earthquakes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we're going to rely on FEMA when there's a big earthquake here, and you know, all this part of downtown is underwater or something,
right?
You know,
you only had to watch what happened in Mexico City, recently, to know that we have got to be prepared for something like that.
Yeah.
And what we need in the way of help is all after the fact. I mean, the hurricane at least came through in 12 hours. Ours is going to happen in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's entirely helping to rebuild that.
And there's concern that the earthquake warning systems, which have been being developed, the funding for that research has been cut back under the Trump administration. That's the kind of thing that could save a lot of lives here in the Bay Area. We know what our problem is. We're located right on major fault lines. There's been a tremendous amount of stuff done here in the Bay Area to safeguard us in buildings like this, right? But the fact is, there's still a lot of people that are going to suffer.
Didn't I tell you this was going to be a feel-good program? You're going to wish the world had ended?
Let's go back to the NFL.
Well, moving on from that disaster, let's talk about North Korea.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So President Trump gave a speech to the United Nations. It did not go over well with John Kelly, his chief of staff. If you saw the photos of John Kelly, you know, doing a facepalm in the audience. But North Korea reacted by saying, well, we could detonate a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific. And then just yesterday or today, the foreign minister of North Korea said that Donald Trump had declared war. On his country. Carla?
Go ahead, Carla.
This is more terrifying than anything, I think. I mean, it really is terrifying. This is how wars start, is this kind of rhetoric that goes back and forth, one-upsmanship. When you listen to experts right here in the Bay Area, people like Corey Shockey at Hoover Institution, who wrote a great piece for The Atlantic saying, look, when you're talking about we can totally destroy North Korea, you know, there's no way to pinpoint their bombs and where they're at, that millions of lives are going to be lost, including probably there's 200,000 Americans that live in South Korea. I mean, the costs of this kind of rhetoric are huge. And I just want to know, where is the outrage among in Congress when this kind of talk is out there on Twitter? It is amazing to me.
Yeah. Well, not just on Twitter, in front of the UN. I mean, the bombastic language, I mean, I guess, is one thing. But, yeah, to threaten to obliterate an entire country, that is different than saying we're going to go after your nukes, we're going to go after your military, right? It's just sort of unhinged, and it really does beg the question, like, what situation are we in when, you know, you're going, is Kim Jong-un more rational? Like, is he a more rational actor?
Yeah.
In the sense that he wants to preserve, you know, not just his life, but his power. And, like, is that what's going to make this war stable? I mean, that's a scary thought.
Do you think he can build international support? He, being President Trump. I mean, George Herbert Walker Bush was a master at that, right? Pulling together, you know, the coalition for the first Gulf War. His son less so successful, but still did build a coalition. I mean, seriously. Donald Trump has not been building coalitions. He did get China to toughen its stance toward North Korea to whatever degree. Just for the sake of playing this through from, you know, what's the possible positive outcome of this besides not having a nuclear incineration? But I mean, you know, what are some of the things that, if this went right, if they're playing any of this in a successful way, what could we see? Because I'm not sure I can identify it right now.
I don't see a path at this point. I hope there is one. I know people like General Kelly, and there are a lot of people in the administration who don't want nuclear war. And I'm trusting that they will, you know, kind of
keep the football away from Trump.
Keep the football away from Trump. But now you have this business with Iran, with him saying he's going to pull out of that deal, and his supporters in Congress are actually saying, no, you have to crack, he's right, you have to crack down on Iran because Kim is seeing that Iran's getting away with everything, and that's why he's doing all the things he's doing. It makes no sense to me because Iran is, people don't like the deal, but Iran is abiding by the deal. And my fear, and a lot of people's, is you break that deal when Iran has been living up to it. Why would Kim negotiate?
Right. Especially after what happened to Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It is unthinkable. I mean, I think that the likely outcome is that they do become a nuclear power, right? Like,
oh, they, yeah.
You know, I mean, he's not going to give up those aspirations. And again, why would he? If you look at the track record, I mean, before Trump, to even take Trump out of it. But yeah, I you know, to the point about a coalition. I mean, what, we're winning China over by this rhetoric? It's just, crazy.
I mean, I know I've heard many foreign policy experts that I've talked to say. The mystery in this whole thing is, you know, when somebody is poking you in the eye on Twitter, you basically ignore them. You don't continue to rile them, and that's exactly what's happening. It's getting to the point where Kim Jong-un is not going to back down because this is now a pride thing.
Yeah.
For his
Well, we were talking about this in the green room beforehand. I remember reading during the, you know, all the talk about weapons of mass destruction, we didn't find them in Iraq, and someone was saying, you know, Saddam Hussein, why didn't he just say, look, I've got nothing, go and look anywhere you want, and I can prove I have nothing? Because for one thing, he would probably be dead within 12 hours, right? Mm-hmm. His whole role as a strong man of Iraq was that he could terrify anyone, he could kill anyone, and his neighbors had to be afraid of him as well, his, you know, international neighbors. Kim Jong-un is not there because he, you know, won a series of primary elections and built up friendships with, you know, other leaders and such. He won because he's the son of the guy who's the son of the guy who, you know, created the dictatorship. He's not going to come out and say, okay, we'll get rid of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons is that regime's major achievement.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly isn't feeding their people.
Yeah. But we have other countries with nuclear weapons that we deal with. You know, India, Pakistan, difficult countries to deal with, but we deal with them, and we don't feel that we have to take them out because they have nuclear weapons. Trump is just setting up North Korea for something different.
Yeah,
backing them into a corner.
Yeah.
Well, let's stay on Trump for a bit. Let's kind of do a roundup of all things Trump. And we have some news lately on the Russia investigation that Robert Mueller is leading. Apparently it is focusing quite clearly on Paul Manafort. It was revealed that he was surveilled by the U.S. government both before and after the election. Arguably, we've all been surveilled by the U.S. government since 9/11, but I think him more specifically so, since they raided his house in July. Where are we kind of right now? What are we learning? What new stuff has been coming out about Russia? Marisa?
I'm just thinking, nobody's taken pictures of my closet, as apparently the FBI did, which is interesting because apparently the reason they do that is to, like, prove if you've been getting kickbacks, right?
Right.
Like, why do you have 18 $3,000 suits? I mean, I think that there's sort of a growing sense, I'm not in D.C., but from what I read and hear, you know, in D.C. that this investigation is closing in, and that, you know, there's a lot of fear and consternation among those close to Trump who are not Trump, who, you know, maybe don't have grandiose ideas of themselves, that whatever comes out of this could be very bad. And I think that, you know, the Manafort stuff is clearly the clearest line back, because what we've learned is that he was being investigated even before he came onto the Trump campaign. Right. But there's a lot of people close to Trump who continue to be investigated, and it just doesn't seem like Mueller's pulling any punches. So
I just think, too, that the many different legs of this investigation are fascinating. When we find out, you know, now Kushner and maybe six people in the White House had emails, private
using their personal
using their
service.
Private
Explain
emails.
That a bit more.
Yeah,
they should go to jail.
Yeah, that's just been that was just news today that not only Jared Kushner, but now apparently six people, including maybe Steve Bannon, in the White House, had their own private email or doing maybe possibly government business on private email. Hello, that's what the whole Hillary Clinton story was about. That was the locker up issue during the election. That whole issue, then the whole issue of Facebook here, right here we've got right in the Bay Area, how Facebook which Mark Zuckerberg has now come out and said, look, we're going to turn 3,000 ads over to the federal government, let them look at who's paying for these ads and what they're all, with the sense that Russian interests were involved. And maybe tracking, now there's stories about how hacked into, I think, 21 state databases.
Yeah, including ours.
This has all come out as a result of sort of Mueller's investigation and different aspects of reporting that's been done by groups, including my own at Politico. I think this we haven't heard the end of it. Mueller's investigation is a slow and steady unfolding that really looks like a lot of us who live through this, like Watergate, in the sense of the way things keep coming out and headlines keep unfolding every day. But the many different sort of legs of this are just fascinating.
Yeah, it seemed to accelerate after the Jared Kushner adoption meeting at Trump Tower. It's just very hard to keep track of. I have not kept track of how many people Mueller has hired. It seems like every other day someone is saying, oh, this ace prosecutor from X has, this ace prosecutor from Y. It feels like he's hired the entire prosecuting force of the East Coast, at least.
And I do think that, Carla, the Facebook thing is really interesting, further afield. But, you know, Zuckerberg and Facebook leadership, it came out this week that Obama actually pulled him aside and gave him a warning about this. And I think that there's a real reckoning happening, you know, not just at Facebook, but within the tech community. Like, there was this sense for a while, we are tech companies, and then, you know, we're not media companies, and, you know,
we shouldn't have to be regulated.
Yeah. Right. And really, more than that, there, you know, there are these forums for politics. Right. And so I think that, as more leaks out, it is pushing them to kind of take a stronger stance. And if you saw Zuckerberg's comments, I believe last week, it's he is sort of turned a huge corner around this. And so I think that coming up on 2018, it's important to kind of watch how, you know, what do they do? How are they proactive? How do they talk about this advertising stuff? Because it's not just politics, right? ProPublica had that great investigation about how, you know, you can target basically hate groups with ads.
That's right.
Facebook goes, oh, that's just an algorithm. Well,
yeah. And this is a story, another story that's based right here in the Bay Area. When you talk about now we're finding out the effects of Google, Twitter, Facebook, all companies based here, on the election and how nobody really understood the levels to which even foreign governments may go to reach American voters through these big platforms. And you're right. The tech community for a long time was, you know, hands off. However, as we all know, on television and radio, ads have been regulated for a long time, political ads. So the fact is that Zuckerberg's comments this week are sort of a recognition, first of all, of the public relations disaster that was coming his way, but also, and Sheryl Sandberg also said the same thing. This was not our intention, targeting anti-Semitic.
To be specific, people were able to buy ads by targeting people using the words Jew haters, among other different things.
Yeah.
And they could buy ads, and then they knew they were getting a certain demographic. And I think especially post-Charlottesville,
That's right.
This
is now a wake-up call, I think, to the whole tech community here in Northern California. So I think that has been interesting to watch.
I think the voter hacking thing is another thing to watch.
I've been
sort of amazed at how our own Secretary of State has gotten a lot of great press about going and pushing back against the voter commission and pushing, you know, a lot of sort of broadening of voter efforts. But he was first confronted with this question of whether our rolls got hacked into in July, and he denied it outright, even as the DA down in Riverside was saying, basically, people showed up to the polls in some Southern California counties on primary day in 2016 and couldn't vote. And it looks as if it was because Russian bots or whoever got in to the state system and changed maybe somebody's voter, you know, their party affiliation, which matters in primaries still for presidential stuff, not other stuff. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other story. But, you know, Alex Padilla has really been strong out there saying we never got hacked. And finally this week he's admitting that our system had been tampered with. And I think that that's a big, big moment and something that we should all be, you know, really holding these officials
accountable
for.
Absolutely. And this is an issue of enormous concern as we're confronting the 2018 elections and you know, the next presidential election, and somebody on either side of the aisle, they better get on this, because
on both sides,
this
is not about a partisan question, right?
It's
about the integrity of our election system.
This is it's a huge thing, and really hasn't been dealt with at all by either state or federal officials.
Also, in the world of Trump, there's an election, a runoff election for the Senate in Alabama, about as red of a state as you can get.
That's right.
And what's interesting, I think, is that these two Republicans, both basically running as Trumpian candidates, however, it's kind of cleaved the Trump world in half, and you have folks like Ben Carson, the Secretary of the Housing and Urban Development, who's supporting one candidate, not the same one his boss Donald Trump is supporting. Mitch McConnell is on the same side as Donald Trump, even though they do not like
each other so much.
Right. And it's kind of interesting that Donald Trump and his candidate is kind of the establishment in this anti-establishment world, whereas Ron Moore, you might have heard his name as the former Chief Justice of Alabama, got bounced from office there for some of his activities. He's running as the anti-establishment candidate, and he's ahead, am I right?
Yes, he's ahead in the polls. He's beloved by conservatives there because he stood up for the Ten Commandments.
And against same-sex marriage.
And against same-sex marriage there.
And against evolution.
Versus Luther Strange.
I don't know that that's still something we can say in terms
of. Versus Luther Strange is the candidate that Trump is supporting. It's going to be viewed as a measure of the strength of Trump endorsements in these races. It's been surprising that whether it's Steve Bannon, Carson, many of the other Republican stalwarts have come out for more on this one, despite the president's endorsement. So I think this is going to be viewed as kind of a watershed moment for how much Trump, his views hold sway within the party.
I can only think that Trump went with Strange because he was McConnell's guy, and it was something Trump could do to try to get McConnell a little more on his side. Because really, the justice is far more Trumpian than Strange.
Yeah, I mean, very strange. So it was at the Strange Alabama rally on Friday where this NFL thing kind of blew up, and at that rally, you know, Trump, I think, sees the writing on the wall for more and sort of tried to say, this is my guy, but the other guy's good too, and maybe I shouldn't have. And it's like, I mean, I feel bad for this guy, but kind of, you kind of do, right? I mean, but it's an interesting quandrum or conundrum for Trump, who, you know, ran as this anti-establishment candidate. Like, how anti-establishment can you be when you're the president of the United States? And how do you keep up that? And, you know, I think this speaks, too, to the zigzagging we've seen him do politically recently. You know, suddenly he's best friends with Nancy and Chuck, and he's making cutting deals with Democrats. And then next week he's on stage with, the farthest right candidates you can find. And I think he doesn't, you know, really know which way to go politically in a lot of these, which is back to our initial topic, which is this NFL thing. It rallies the base. But at the same time, he's talking about protecting the Dream Act. And so... Yeah, man. You guys, it's only been 9 months.
Well, before we move on to another topic, let's stick with Donald Trump because he's renewed his battle, if you will, with Senator John McCain. And, you know, John McCain, of course, again, voted did not support the latest Obamacare repeal effort. Trump specifically blamed him and said, John McCain's the reason we can't repeal it. John McCain also, in a separate article I saw, and was noting that President Trump never apologized for saying he was not a war hero.
That's right.
Are we seeing the last chapter of John McCain?
You know, this is to me kind of a personal thing because I, as a in 2000, rode along with John McCain in the Straight Talk Express bus, covered his campaign. It was one of the most incredible campaign experiences you could ever have to sit on a bus with a candidate for 8-10 hours a day and just be no handlers, nobody filtering. And it was just like being with an incredible like philosophy professor where you just had debates going back and forth. Yeah. He was just completely courageous in doing that. It got him in trouble a couple of times because he was very plain spoken. But to follow him around the country, however he stands on issues and whether you disagree with him or not on many issues, that experience showed me he really is sort of... a breed in the U.S. Senate. His decision to stand up on this health care bill at the last moment and give the thumbs down was very courageous, considering the heat he was under from Trump, and to come out first this time around,
right,
and basically give cover to everybody else and say, you know what, this is not the way this process should work. However you feel about Obamacare. I just think McCain's current battle with cancer is just something to watch and something that we should all, be with him on in that sense because when it comes to courage, I mean, the guy had it, and as a campaigner, he certainly had it too.
Just to, glioblastoma is a pretty vicious cancer, and he has to know that his time here is limited. And to want to do this, to make this stand, probably as one of his last real stands, I'm just, a fan. Except for Sarah Palin. He lost me with Sarah Palin. I was a fan before. He did, when he came for his campaign interview with us in 2000, he came without any handlers.
Yeah.
It was just, he just walked just, in. Yeah. You know,
super rare.
It was very strange. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it speaks to, I mean, I don't know that we won't see other people like this, because as I noted, I think we do have, in Collins and Murkowski and others who are not just towing the party line, we do have some folks who are being courageous as well, but it sort of speaks to the split, I think. When you look at, we were sort of muddling earlier, like, why why are they still pushing this Obamacare repeal? And I think in some ways, you know, in the House and Paul Ryan and that sort of group, it speaks to their just hardcore philosophical beliefs in a different form of government and democracy than a lot of people on the left have. And they are sort of clinging to those in spite of, you know, every evidence to the contrary, that that's not what America really wants right now. And then I think in Mitch McConnell, you have someone who's sort of the consummate politician. Like, he just wants to win, right? More than, and so I do think that when you watch someone like McCain, who really has come out, I mean, more so than on a policy level, but protecting the institution of the Senate as a deliberative body, which is like kind of boring to talk about, but as somebody who's watched up close in Sacramento and in city halls, like, those things are important, right? The history and the decorum of individual bodies and how they approach legislating really can make the difference between good and bad policy. Yeah. And so, you know, I know there's a lot of talk about his closeness with Lindsey Graham and if that would impact, you know, his decision. And I think we really saw that, you know, to him, just the lack of a bipartisan attempt. And Collins echoed that, saying, you know, you can't shove through this type of policy overnight.
I thought it was interesting. The first time he came back from when we first learned about his treatment, and he came back and he cast that first vote against when he made the decision, I guess one of the first people he went to was Senator Dianne Feinstein, again is another one of these people who very much feels about the way the Senate should be run, the what it means that it operates a certain way. So there are others there who still share his commitment, I think. Well, one last topic before we get to news quiz and some more of your questions.
Happy one?
Well, maybe we should
from a perspective. No, it's not. So you remember the name Milo Yiannopoulos? Can you spell it? No, you can't. But
we can all say it now.
It's our first news quiz question.
Yes. So he was going to. He had announced he was going to hold a free speech week at UC Berkeley. He called it off this weekend, and there have been a lot of kind of questioning about what he was up to in doing this in the first place. He still showed up. UC Berkeley had to spend $800,000 in security for what turned out to be him giving a 15-minute photo op, PR speech. And this is, you know, this is on top of the $600,000 that the UC Berkeley spent on security for Ben Shapiro when he spoke. Of course, when Ben Shapiro spoke at the club, we didn't spend anything on security. But it wasn't because we didn't care about
it. Well, 2 years ago, nobody showed up at Berkeley either.
Yeah. But what do you think about, I mean, how do you think Berkeley handled this well? Could they have handled it differently? I mean, they clearly had to have security.
Yeah, no, I think this was kind of a no-win situation for Berkeley, because if they had had violence, they would have been jammed on that. They had the Ben Shapiro event. They had proper security. Everything went off fine. I think this was a case where Mr. Yiannopoulos, who's a political provocateur, just this was a PR event in which he... and I think the Mercury called it right, a setup, essentially. Mm-hmm. He threw it out there that he was going to do this, used a student group.
A newly created student
group.
A newly created student group
that hadn't updated its website in years, announced all these incredible speakers, Steve Bannon, Ann Coulter.
Who never knew they were speaking.
And, the media kept announcing that these people were going to show up, and it got bigger and bigger. In the end... I think Milo was basically outed. It was a fake event, and he showed up. 25 people. I think that in that respect, the left had an interesting response, which was ignore the guy.
Finally,
yeah, which people have said they should.
His 15 minutes of fame now. But the fact is, I think for Berkeley, this was a dilemma, because the last time he was going to speak, remember, violent protests. It was really ugly, and they had to make sure that didn't happen again.
I have to say, Antifa is a fairly creepy organization. I mean, black hoods are no better than white hoods to me. I mean, And it really has cast a negative light on the left in much the way that, I mean, it doesn't have the history of the Klan, but, you know, when you look at Charlottesville, you have one thing. Antifa didn't look any better when it came out at the last rally. So I would love to see that get under control.
Can I build on that? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say, like, I think that you do have to give the new chancellor at Berkeley a lot of credit. I mean, I think she's sort of threaded a needle that her predecessor was unable to. And as, you know, as much as was spent, I think, like, the jig is kind of up for Milo, who I think it is generous to call a provocateur. Yeah. I would say a troll is more like it. Yeah, yeah. Because there is a difference between a Ben Shapiro or even a Steve Bannon, who may not agree with anything they say, but who are coming from a point of view, and someone like him, and I would say, to some extent, Ann Coulter, who are there just to piss people off. And so I think that the university, you know, spent all this money to keep people safe, and the only anti-protesters who showed up at this one are sort of crazy in themselves because they're telling the media not to to dox them by, you know, giving their protests, which the whole point of is to get PR coverage of, like, not to cover. I mean, so, but I think that, you know, when you've seen the backtracking of the student group and they, you know, from the beginning were saying, well, we don't agree with what they say either, but we believe in free speech. And, you know, I don't think you can argue anybody's free speech has been under attack here. The question is, do you sort of stand up and, you know, take the response to that free speech, which I think a lot of these folks on the right don't want to, right?
So there was, sort of related to this, there's a Brookings Institution survey recently that came out of college students, and it was asking them about their views on free speech and the First Amendment, and I think some of the results probably are kind of surprising. More than half of respondents said it was acceptable to shout down a speaker if you disagree with their views. In fact, 62% of self-described Democratic students found it acceptable. 61% of the Republicans disagreed. A strong majority, about the same regardless of party affiliation, agreed that violence to prevent a speaker from speaking is unacceptable. So, good. Big majorities, more than 60% for members of both parties of college students, said that the First Amendment requires the inclusion of opposing views. It doesn't. But, so, then students were asked to choose between or their views on these two different options. One was, it's more important to create a positive learning environment for all students by prohibiting certain speech or expression of viewpoints that are offensive or biased against certain groups of people. 61% of Democrats agreed with that.
Wow.
47% of Republicans agreed with that. Independents, 45% agreed with it. So overall, it was 53% of college students agreed that with that. The other option was create an open learning environment where students are exposed to all types of speech and viewpoints, even if it means allowing speech that is offensive or biased against certain groups of people. And the only majority on that was, well, actually, Republicans and independents supported that with more than half. Only 39% of campus Democrats agreed with that.
Interesting.
Do Democrats have a free speech problem on campus?
That's exactly why I think some of these groups and people like Milo are targeting Berkeley. That it's just great headlines, but it's also, as you said, Barbara, you've got some of these more radical groups that come out. Mm-hmm. I think that's a disturbing survey for sure.
It is, and I think it's an argument for more and better civic education in school, because kids should at least know what they can disagree with the First Amendment, but they should at least know what it says and what it means.
We go back to the taking the knee issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Back where we started.
Civic engagement at every level of it.
This makes me think about when I first arrived in San Francisco. I covered city politics for a while before I went up to Sacramento, and I remember being amazed at how civil things were in Sacramento comparatively. Like, the Republicans and Democrats would go out and have a drink after they disagreed. And, you know, I think there's some danger in when everybody is on one side, regardless of whether it's the right or left, but they're surrounded by people that generally agree with them. You tend to make disagreements more personal. If you see this at City Hall here a lot, right? So, you know, when Gavin Newsom was mayor, it's not that, you know, maybe his policy position were wrong. It's like he's a bad person. And so I think that that kind of sort of, you know, self-sheltering can lead to this. And this idea, you know, that we need to be protected instead of open to other viewpoints.
Okay, we now come to the group therapy session of the program. Because since January, probably actually since November, November 8th, let's say, 9th, whenever the election was, we always will get questions week to week, and they're always along the lines of, will Donald Trump be impeached? Can Donald Trump be impeached? Please, dear God, tell me Donald Trump can be impeached. Tonight, we have questions. I have resigned myself to this presidency, so they're on whatever stage of grief that is. Give me a reason to hold out hope that things will change for the better, so they haven't really accepted. What will it take to get Trump out of office before he blows up the world? So before we go to the news quiz, any hope or dampening of hope that any of you wish to offer?
I wish I knew.
I don't think any of us can predict where this is going to go. I mean, some days it looks like he's going to be reelected. You know, that's just the way it's going. Or he's going to be impeached. This is the most uncertain news cycle that we've ever experienced, any of us, correct?
Impeachment would require the Republican Party, the Republicans in Congress, to admit to what I'm sure a fair number of them actually
think. Which is why
the
midterms might be so intimate.
Yes, it may be the...
Yeah, I think I've heard some folks on the left say the impeachment trial starts on, you know, next November, on Election Day. I'll just say this. I spent my summer vacation rereading all the President's Men, and I think 2 years it took from the break-in to resignation, which I would bet would be... If Trump does not serve out one or two terms, I would bet resignation might happen before impeachment. But I think you should be careful what you wish for as a Democrat.
Yeah.
On that note, let us move to the news quiz section. If my prize delivery person can come forward. Is that Colette? Yes. So if you've not ever seen us do this before, I'll quickly give you a description of what we do. I'll read a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. Raise your hand. I'll point at you. Then you can shout it out. If you're right, Colette gives you a little bag of chocolate. If you're wrong, try again. So our first question. While visiting storm-damaged areas of Florida last week, Donald Trump greeted the locals and said he knew his wife Melania wished she could be there. What was strange about that? Your hand shot up before anyone's.
Melania
was standing right next to him. That is correct. So following elections in the Federal Republic of Germany, a far-right party will enter the Bundestag for the first time in the post-war years. What's the name of that party? Sir, your hand way in back there. The AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland. That is correct. Just days after unveiling a monument in Moscow to the creator of the Kalashnikov rifle, the statue had to be altered. Why? And, sir, you saw your hand up right away.
It had the wrong rifle.
It had a German rifle that the Nazis used. They fixed that right away. Next question. Actor Colin Firth, who opposed UK's Brexit vote, has taken up citizenship in what other country? Sir, along the wall. I'm sorry, your hand went up. Italy, that's correct. Sorry, he had his hand up first. On a trip to Toronto, who met with Prince Harry and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau? Ma'am, you went right away.
Melania.
That's
Susan.
you can share the chocolate. Melania Trump, that is correct. I assume she told them she knew her husband wished he could be there. Today, former Congressman Anthony Weiner was sentenced to what? Sir, I saw your hand there. Sir, in the white light shirt, 21 months in prison. That is correct. Let's see.
Yeah. That would have been like a topic.
Okay. A group of several dozen conservative Roman Catholic theologians and priests accused whom of heresy? Ma'am. Pope Francis, that is correct. Okay. On Friday, a series of U.S. airstrikes hit an Islamic State compound in what country? Way in the back there, sir. You, sir, yes. Libya, that is correct. Libya. let's see. On Sunday, one person was killed and seven injured in a church shooting outside what major U.S. city? Ma'am in the green. Nashville, right, in Antioch. Let's see. Who said President Trump was on a suicide mission? Way in the back there, sir. It was right. His foreign minister of Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Who did Hillary Clinton say was the most important leader in the free world? Ma'am, right there. Angela Merkel of Germany. That's correct. German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Oh, I'm sorry. Ma'am, raise your hand so she can get you. She's the most powerful person in the free world. She was sitting right amongst you all this time. That's how greatness happens. It's fantastic. And Colette, we have one more?
Yes.
Okay, it's got to be a good question. Not that one. That's not good. This is a good story. What California small businessman received more than $87,000 raised for him by supporters? Ma'am, along the wall there? That's right. The Berkeley hot dog vendor who was fined or had his money taken away for selling bacon hot dogs without a permit. Selling bacon hot dogs should be like a mission that you should be rewarded for.
I think it's the First Amendment.
College students wouldn't agree with that, though. Listen, for our next week-to-week program, we're actually heading down to Silicon Valley. So on October 16th, we'll be down in Palo Alto. But we'll be back here on the 31st. We hope to see as many of you as can make it. Thank you to our wonderful panel, Marisa Lagos, Barbara Marchman, Carla Marinucci. Thanks to all of you for coming out tonight and everyone watching online. Have a great week.